Today, the Guardian story that sparked a landmark legal fight against a tobacco company, and covering the wildfires that have forced thousands to flee their homes in California. In 2018, The Guardian's health editor Sarah Bosley began an investigation into the tobacco industry. She had no idea where the story was going to take her, but in January last year, she got on a plane and travelled to Malawi. Her plan was to visit the central region where tobacco leaves were being harvested and where she had heard that many of the people farming the land were children. What she discovered shocked her. Families trapped in a cycle of debt with no choice but to employ their children on the land, and all for a crop that every year brings in billions in profit to a large multinational.
The thought of children actually working in tobacco fields producing a crop like this that is so harmful just seemed to be completely toxic.
Sarah published the story and hoped that it might generate some interest, but she was greeted with silence, or so she thought. Just over a year later, a UK law firm who had read her report decided to take action and are suing British American Tobacco. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how a Guardian investigation resulted in a landmark legal case.
Salika is a man of 41. He comes from the eastern region of Malawi. He has a wife called Elina. And they have four children. They have a girl who is 13. A boy of 10, another one of 8. And a baby. They are very, very poor people who have been persuaded to go to the north where there's a huge amount of tobacco farmland because they think they're going to be able to earn a great deal of money. He said he wanted to start a second-hand clothes business, which probably means all those sacks of clothes that come from the UK, and he would be the middleman who takes them to the market and sells them there. It would be a better life for him, a much better life than the sort of life he's living in the north of Malawi on the tobacco farm, where it's sunrise until sundown, just hard labour.
What kind of work is it that Silica and his family are having to do?
What was happening at the time we were there, which was the very start of the farming, tobacco farming season, the first thing they have to do is clear the ground, and that's of last year's dead crop as much as anything else, dead tobacco plants. The 13-year-old girl and the 10-year-old boy actually work hard with hoes, so they will actually dig the earth, which would be quite tough for me, I have to say. And the smaller children were collecting up the dead plants and piling them up into heaps that can then be set on fire. So that's the first task they have to do. So from about 4 a.m, they're clearing fields, and then they will go to school, probably. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And that will depend on whether the family can afford the small fees that there are to send them to school.
So Silica spends time in this region for 10 months for the season, and then when the crop is harvested, is he able to go back home with his family?
Silica and all the rest of the farmers hope to go home when they get their cash for the crop, and that's going to be around July, August time. But what invariably happens is that they have had to borrow money along the way. They have no money at all. They get a sack of maize from the contract farmer who owns the land per month to feed the family. So what they're living on, what they're actually eating, is maize porridge. It's called nsima. With a few weedy things that grow in the fields that they call relish. They sort of pound it up and with some water. Basically, there is no money along the way. So the money only comes when the crop is sold at the end of the 10 months. Before that, they're borrowing money the whole time, and they have to borrow for extra food if they need it. The maize flour actually ends in March. It doesn't last for the entire tenancy period. and they have to pay some money for school fees. All the money they need along the way they have to borrow, that is then deducted from the amount they get for their crop.
So how much could this family make over one season, typically, after the money has been deducted?
So Salika last season earned 180,000 kwacha, Malawian kwacha. That is about £180. That was actually for 10 months' work for himself, his wife, and all his children. But after deductions, he had 140,000 kwacha left, which is about £140.
Gosh.
What that means, of course, is that they're trapped. They can't afford to go home. That means they have to stay. Then they will stay until the next season begins. And while they stay, they're not being paid, so they have to borrow money.
How does this way of life impact on Silica's children?
Silica's children can't get a proper education. They are really tired most of the time because of the labour in the fields, obviously. And that's before and after school and at weekends. And in the harvest time, of course, everybody's out. Nobody goes to school at all because it's absolutely everybody's work is needed. He told me that they can't afford the exam fees, so those days they skip, which means that they can't progress because under the Malawian education system, you have to pass the exams in order to get up to the next class.
Salika and others like him are one tiny part of a vast industry. Where does the tobacco he picks end up? What is that production line?
The first thing to understand is that the farmers here are tenant farmers. They are the poorest of the poor. They actually come from other areas of Malawi and are transported very often by contract farmers to the north. Contract farmers own land, or at least rent land, so they're the next up in the food chain, if you like. They're called contract farmers because they have a contract with a leaf buying company. In this case, it's called Alliance One. It's a big company that buys tobacco leaf on behalf, in this case, of British American Tobacco.
Just to put this into context, British American Tobacco makes cigarettes that are sold all over the world. You've got brands like Dunhill, Kent, Lucky Strike, Pall Mall, Rothmans. And here in the UK, you know, a pack of cigarettes costs people sort of, what, like £8, £9 for a pack of 20. But in that supply chain, who is it who would be seeing most of the money from the cigarettes that we buy?
It's undoubtedly the cigarette company. It's British American Tobacco who make the most money out of this whole business. BAT is a hugely profitable company. So last year, their profit was over £9 billion on a turnover of something like 24.
When you published that first story about this in June 2018, what were your expectations?
I really felt this was a hugely important story, and I have felt that before about some stories, and sometimes something happens, but very often it doesn't. With this one, I thought, surely something has to come out of this. We have shown up this terrible thing that's happening. These very, very hardworking people, you know, whose children just do not have a chance in life. And I don't know what I expected, but I expected there to be repercussions of some sort. And I remember being completely frustrated because it just seemed to go into a void.
But it didn't go into a void, because it was seen by one of the UK's top international human rights lawyers, Martin Day, senior partner at Lee Day.
I still remember now the day I picked up the paper and saw the story. It's a case that had come across my radar a good few years before. An American lawyer asked us if we wanted to get involved, but we were at that stage really busy on another case and it rather just passed me by. And reading Sarah's story just reminded me absolutely that some of the thoughts I'd had at the time, but it was so evocative, the story. It really made me feel now is the time. We've really got to do something about this if we can.
And Martin, you've been a solicitor for many years, and your firm, Lee Day, I think was once described by The Guardian as troublemakers who are the thorn in the side of multinationals. What kind of cases are you really drawn to?
since the firm was started in 1987, the whole idea of it was to actually represent ordinary individuals, in the, whether in this country or from abroad. And what we've been particularly doing in more recent times, certainly my team, has been bringing cases against multinationals and indeed the British government in terms of what they do abroad in the developing world. And so we've had a whole series of cases against many, many different British multinationals. We try not to discriminate. We'll take them all on as and when we find the case. It's been one of the great pleasures of my life to when we've had a significant number of victories, bringing justice for people who otherwise would never get it.
So what happened? You finished reading Sarah's piece, and what did you do next?
Well, we talked about it internally first. What was crucial for us was that British American Tobacco is obviously based here in London. We can only bring cases effectively where one of the perpetrators is based here in this country. Primary point to start off with is, well, obviously one thing us deciding that we think there's a good case there, but there's another thing to the local people who are actually affected. Do they actually want to bring a case? So we got some various contact people from Sarah. We then made contact with the local NGOs and the local activists, and there was a very, very strong desire for us to help. So we then arranged to go over to Malawi to start seeing it for ourselves.
Were you shocked by how young some of the children were who were working?
The age of the kids was a big surprise, actually. I mean, it was in my mind that you'd be mainly talking about kids of 12, 13, 14, 15. But actually on the ground, you see kids like 4, 5, 6 who are actually helping, doing jobs tied into the farming process.
Your colleagues spent more time travelling back and forth to Malawi, collecting accounts from farmers and working alongside Malawian paralegals and translators. And then at the end of September, you sent a letter to British American Tobacco, giving them notice that you were going to sue them for unjust enrichment. What does that mean?
What we say is that the poor level of payment that is made to the clients basically forced them into this circle of poverty where they can't get out of it. And the only route to them being able to even survive, never mind make any money, is to employ the whole family, including the kids.
And what are the other charges you're bringing against British American Tobacco?
In the letter of claim which we sent to BAT, we set out a whole series of issues that we feel of concern in terms of their operations, not least being issues like trafficking, debt bondage, deferral holding of withholding of due payments, food insecurity, hunger, poor living and working conditions, the illnesses and injuries that we say they're responsible in terms of the dangerous working practices that they operate. So a whole series of what we saw on the ground was the workers live in the most terrible, terrible situation. And we feel that BAT should be held to account for that.
How many claimants were in that letter?
So in the letter of claim that we sent to BAT, there were around 430 adults, which broadly half and half women and men, and then 360 odd children in that claim letter. Since when we've taken on more and more cases, so we're more than double that now. It's obviously early days, but my best estimate at this stage is I think around 15,000 is a realistic figure as to the likely number of claimants, both farmers and their kids.
15,000? Did you say 1,500 earlier?
1,500 is what we got on already. 15,000 is what we anticipate by the end of it.
Huge.
A lot of people.
Sarah, it must have been amazing to know that all this work was being done in part as a result of your story. And 2 weeks ago, you and Martin went back to Malawi together. Why did you go?
I got a call from Lee Day saying, hey, we're doing a case. And I could have fallen off my chair because I honestly didn't think it would happen. And it had been about a year. So then they said, would you like to go out? And absolutely bit their hand off and said, yes, love to. I went out with David Levine, the photographer. The two of us had done all the previous coverage. I was absolutely stunned by what they were doing, because I think I assumed that there might be one Lee Day lawyer there. There's this massive operation going on.
Good morning, everybody.
So they were setting up tables outside a village school. There were loads of people coming, but it was just the sheer size of the team that was there. And obviously they really, really meant business.
British American Tobacco is one of the largest companies in the whole world.
And this is all part of the process, wanting to find more and more people who you can bring this case on the part of.
And we have interviewed many children, and they all say we do not want to be farming tobacco when we're older.
One of the great pleasures of the job is standing in front of clients, explaining to them what the case is about.
The way the case will work is that we will do the case on what we call a no-win, no-fee.
It's how the process is going to work, and then fielding their questions.
Sarah, how do the families you've spoken to feel about this case that is being brought?
The families I spoke to were really happy that something was going to be done. They were all of them very distressed by the situation they were in.
Do you think the farmers are scared of retaliation for speaking out?
The farmers are nervous that there could be some comeback. And I know that Lidé is being very careful about identifying them for that reason. And we're being careful with what we do too. But luckily, there is strength in numbers as well. So it would be very hard, actually, for the company or the leaf buyers to pick off people, I think.
Martin, what is the next step now?
We are awaiting British American Tobacco's response to our letter of claim. That should come in a few weeks' time. And from there, obviously, we'll review what they have to say, and we'll then get into issuing proceedings against them. We will move this case along as absolutely as fast as we can and try and get it into trial within 3 years or so.
And what do you want for the families?
These are families who have ended up with having to live on just a few hundred pounds a year. And if we can try and break through that in two ways, one is to get them compensation for what they've been through over the past many, many years. And secondly, hopefully as a result of that, force BAT into changing its systems so that these people are paid a much more fair amount for their labours.
Are companies like British American Tobacco structured in such a way that they can avoid liability as much as possible in cases like these?
Well, we wait to see what the BAT say in their letter of response. But, you know, I could well imagine that they'll be trying to say, look, all we do is pay an amount for tobacco. We pay it to the leaf buyers, and it's not really our fault if they pay a minimal amount to the tenant farmers and the contract farmers. You know, I can well see that they will try and wash their hands of it and say, look, this is all arm's length. Don't blame us, blame somebody else. But we are clear from all that we have seen that it is all part of the same system, the same structure that has been set up throughout Malawi has meant that the amount of money that trickles down to the tenant farmers is a mere pittance. I feel confident, obviously. We wouldn't be bringing the case if we didn't feel confident that we have a pretty decent chance of winning.
Sarah, we're still in the very early stages of this process and we're not sure where it's going to lead. But if this case is successful, could this potentially have a big impact on the families that you've spoken to?
First of all, it could really improve conditions for the families working for British American Tobacco. And not only them, but all the tenant farmers who are actually working in the tobacco industry. Because if BAT has to improve the amount of money they give families and their working conditions, after all, nobody's going to work for the other companies unless they do the same. So that could have a major impact. And then secondly, it could actually have an effect on child labour around the entire world. Because if a British company can be sued in the High Court and have to pay damages to children for making them work, then any other British company that's also using child labour indirectly, say in the garment trade, for instance, could also be vulnerable. So it really does mean it could have an effect on child labour.
Sarah, Martin, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You're very welcome.
Since we recorded this interview and in response to Lidé's legal action, the US has suspended all imports of tobacco from Malawi. In response to the allegations made, British American Tobacco gave us this statement. British American Tobacco takes the issue of child labour extremely seriously. We do not condone forced, bonded or involuntary labour, and we do not condone or employ child labour and seek to ensure that the welfare, health and safety of children are paramount at all times. Furthermore, we make it clear to all of our contracted farmers and suppliers that exploitative child labour and forced and bonded labour will not be tolerated. These minimum standards are expected of all of our suppliers worldwide and are incorporated into our contractual arrangements with each supplier. As we have received a letter of claim relating to these allegations, it would be inappropriate for us to provide further comment at this time. Sarah will continue to follow this case at theguardian.com, where you can also read all of her reporting from her recent trip, along with photos taken by David Levine. Coming up, The Guardian's Susie Cagle on the devastation caused by wildfires in California. Now, California's annual wildfires are getting progressively worse, burning huge areas of land and destroying people's homes. This year is no different, and fires have blazed across the state for the past few weeks. The Guardian's climate and environment reporter, Susie Cagle, has been reporting on them and explains how this cycle of devastation is leading some to think that California is becoming unlivable.
Wildfire smoke smells different. You know it's not your neighbor's barbecue or a bonfire. You know what this means. You know you have to go. If you're lucky, you might see the flames in the distance and know that you have a little bit of time. Time enough to grab a bag and important papers, family photos, your pets. But most of the time, you just need to go with the clothes you have on your back, running to your car, trying to get out. California has always had fires, especially in the fall. The spring makes everything grow, and the summer heat dries it all out. And then in the fall, the winds start to blow, and the fires take hold. But California hasn't always had fires like these. Over the last few years, fires in California have been getting progressively worse. In 2017, more than 10,000 buildings across the state were damaged or destroyed, and 47 people were killed. The fires caused $18 billion in damages to people and businesses. And 2018 was even worse. There are vast inequalities between people in California, and it's no different after fire. Some people are much better equipped to deal with the impacts of a fire than others. They might have better insurance, or they can take time off work. They might be able to hire people to help them sort through all of the toxic mess that their once beloved home has now become. Other people have no insurance at all, and they have to keep working, sometimes while the fire keeps burning, working in the fields, on construction sites, and they might only have a little paper mask between them and all of that smoke. When you talk to someone who's faced a fire in California before and has lost it all, and now they're facing it again, you can hear that determination. Many people don't want to leave. These are their homes.
No plans on leaving unless it...
I'm not leaving. I left the last time.
Yeah. It certainly doesn't seem... It's not the same as last time.
It seems worse.
Really?
Yeah.
So why is this happening? Climate change has made California hotter and drier, and it's made those winds in the fall blow harder and faster. All of the vegetation across the state is ready to burn. At the same time, the old electric power grid that keeps California's lights on is starting a lot of these fires. Those old lines just aren't able to withstand those new, faster winds. And faulty power lines can start fires in a number of ways. California is trying to adapt. This year, the power companies decided to shut off the power when the wind started blowing, blacking out millions of people across the state. Fire departments have hired hundreds of new firefighters, put in fuel breaks around neighborhoods. To some degree, they've been successful, but the fires still started. So many people moved to California for a better life. They had a vision of the Golden State full of opportunity and green hills. But it's facing an existential question. How can this one state fight climate change? Are millions of people going to be forced from their homes in the wildlands Is the state going to spend billions of dollars burying power lines in the ground so they don't start these fires? Who is going to pay for that? And is it even worth it?
That was Susie Cagle. Thanks to her, Sarah Bosley and Martin Day. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.